This is VOA News coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. The death toll in yesterday's passenger jet crash in Pakistan is put at 97. Two survivors are being treated for their injuries and are reported doing well. One of them, Mohammed Zubair, said after the Airbus 320 hit the ground and burst into flames, all he could see was fire and all he heard were screams. He said he made his escape by jumping from the burning wreckage. Minutes before the tragedy, the pilot told air traffic controllers he had lost power in both engines. The plane was about to land in Karachi on a flight from Lahore when it went down in a residential area. Here in the United States, Memorial Day weekend is well underway, with Monday recognized as the unofficial start of summer. 1.8 billion Muslims around the world this weekend are marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan. But the coronavirus pandemic observes no holidays. COVID-19 is now taking close to 339,000 lives worldwide, with 5.2 million people sickened. In the U.S., the numbers from Johns Hopkins University, 1.6 million cases and 96,000 deaths. All 50 American states are reopening their economies at varying rates of speed. In Michigan, a pandemic hotspot, Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer has extended her declared state of emergency through mid-June. Michigan has almost 54,000 virus cases and a death toll approaching 5,200. As a contrast, the state of Texas, with almost as many cases as Michigan, is moving full speed ahead on reopening. Its population is 29 million, the largest of all the states. The daily death toll in New York is down to 84. Governor Andrew Cuomo says he's trying to make it as easy as possible for people to get tested. New York at one point was the epicenter of the pandemic. Public health officials in the U.S. are warning against complacency in practicing mitigation efforts aimed at controlling the spread of the coronavirus. A key is social distancing, but that could prove difficult during a long holiday weekend, which is traditionally celebrated with large gatherings. More news online at voanews.com. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump says churches and other houses of worship in the U.S. should be allowed to open this weekend, and says he will overrule any governor who fails to go along with his edict, though he cites no authority to do that. Most American houses of worship have been closed amid fears that drawing large numbers of people for services creates an ideal situation for the further spread of disease. The president's words are being criticized by some as a blatant appeal to his conservative political base, especially evangelicals, as Mr. Trump campaigns for re-election. Coronavirus news elsewhere. COVID-19 has quickened its pace of infections in Latin America, Russia, India, and Pakistan. With some 3,700 fatalities, India has seen its biggest single-day spike in cases yet. And the nation of 1.3 billion people counts 125,000 victims of the virus. In Pakistan, there are more than 52,000 cases and 1,100 deaths. Russia reports almost 336,000 people down with COVID-19, second only to the U.S. The country's official death toll is rising from about 3,400. Turkey has toughened its pandemic lockdown. It wants to avoid large celebrations to mark the end of Ramadan. In Latin America, Mexico and Brazil are pandemic hot zones. Brazil, where President Jair Bolsonaro long downplayed the threat of the coronavirus, now has the third highest number of cases in the world, 331,000. Brazil's hospitals are running out of space to treat COVID victims, and with 21,000 lives lost, it has become difficult to dig new graves quickly enough. In Mexico, too, the pandemic has been running rampant, more than 62,000 virus cases and nearly 7,000 fatalities. Colombia saw its largest number of new confirmed COVID infections on Friday, 801, pushing its total above 19,000. With another 30 deaths, Colombia has a fatality count of close to 700. There is far different news from China. For the first time since the COVID-19 outbreak was born in the city of Wuhan, China today has reported no new cases. Among the newest signs of economic distress in the United States, after more than 100 years in business, car rental giant Hertz has filed for bankruptcy. By the end of March, Hertz had piled up some $24 billion in debt, its operations hobbled by a pandemic that put a lid on most non-essential travel. At this point, Hertz says it has only $1 billion on hand and that the company's lenders had refused to grant further extensions on its auto lease debt obligations. Hertz also owns Dollar and Thrifty Car Rental. Says Hertz CEO Catherine Marinello, no business is built for zero revenue. In Britain, children are scheduled to return to classrooms in June. Most schools in the UK have been closed since March 20th. The reopenings are to be done in stages beginning on June 1st with 4 to 6-year-olds. Day centers will be open as well. More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
An injury to one is an injury to all. Inasmuch as the coalition is re-strategizing for 2023 general election, Ikenga Imugochinye remains our best bet for now in the projection of our collective interests as a spokesperson.
A major Nigerian opposition party says it will continue to hold the government accountable for its actions.
We can defeat the pandemic provided that the government learns from its mistakes, improves care for the sick, intensifies screening and improves communication. To the citizens, I will tell them that the disease is real and I will invite them to observe the barrier measures.
A Burkina Faso opposition leader says ongoing efforts to limit the spread of the coronavirus remain poor.
Let's learn from successful countries. I'm not a believer of reinventing the wheel, Peter, or in our case, ignoring perfectly sound scientific recommendations.
And a Tanzanian human rights activist says plans for a party to celebrate the end of the coronavirus in Dar es Salaam is unfortunate and regrettable. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Coalition of United Political Parties, or CUPP, a major Nigerian opposition group, says it is unacceptable for leading members of the ruling party to use state institutions to intimidate and harass its members. This after the National House of Representatives invited Ikenga Imugochinye, spokesperson for the CUPP, to explain accusations that the lawmakers were influenced with $10 million. Attorney Kenneth Udeze, the CUPP head of mobilization and also leader of the Opposition Action Alliance, tells me that the CUPP will continue to hold the government accountable for its actions. This, in spite of what he says, is clear evidence of the use of state institutions to persecute opponents of the administration.
Yeah, you see, the present APC regime is a predictable regime that can do anything on two words to get at the opposition. Ordinarily, we shouldn't have come to the House of Representatives considering the locus classicus that we already have via a federal high court order stopping the Honorable Henry Nwabubasa ad hoc committee from further probing the opposition spokesperson Ikenga Imugochinye, but to also show that we are willing, very, very willing, to defend our vote of confidence on our spokesperson and to mount surveillance and observe any possible further attempt to cage the opposition coalition through any form of legislative lawlessness which the speaker have exhibited presently.
Does your group, the CUPP, of the view that the speaker doesn't have the right to launch an investigation into impropriety allegedly by the spokesperson of your group, Ikenga Imugochinye?
The speaker cannot be ignorant of the principle of nemo judes in casu suo. No one is a judge in his own case. He should respect the doctrine of lis pendis, that once a matter is before the court of law, all parties are enjoined to maintain status quo. He is the person in the eye of the storm. Ordinarily, he should vacate his seat and come to answer the allegations against him instead of resorting to self-help if he's a worthy gentleman. There is more to the rush in the vaccination bill that will be unveiled during the court hearing.
What do you say to critics of Ikenga, who are of the view that he made spurious allegations against the Speaker of the National House of Representatives, so he should face the full force of the law if these allegations are found to be just to tarnish the reputation of the Speaker of the House of Representatives? What's your take on this?
There is no human without critics and haters. Even as good and wonderful our Savior Jesus was, he still passed through the storm of strong and evil critics. You see, of all men's vices, the worst is ingratitude. Nigerians owe Ikenga Imugochinye gratitude for standing against the anti-people's policies of the authorities and some agents of reaction and provocation in our midst. If anybody claims that he makes spurious allegations against the speaker, why not then wait for the court to find him liable of such offense before concluding? I would rather say that those critics are the ones making spurious allegations against the opposition spokesperson. That is what I can tell you on this.
Kenneth, some people are saying if he has nothing to hide, why didn't he go to the committee established by the Speaker of the National House of Representatives to answer the questions or face the allegations against him or the query or investigation against him?
Let me make it abundantly clear that CUPP spokesperson has nothing to hide. When the CUPP secured a criminal summons against the Speaker for preferring his client's money in the U.S., why did the Speaker fail to appear in court? You see, in this climb, the character of the men in ruling party, particularly the APC regime, is that of calling a dog a bad name in order to hang it. We know we are dining with the devils, and we are well equipped with our long spoon. We in the opposition, having reviewed the coordinated plans and witch hunt against our spokesperson, who is more or less the engine room of the opposition coalition, we advise him in the contrary. We are in court, and nothing more pretentious about it.
But what is the status of Ikenga at the moment? Is he still speaking on behalf of the CUPP, or the leadership wants him to step aside until all these issues are resolved amicably so he could return and take his position within the party?
The status of Ikenga Imugochinyere as the opposition spokesperson is like Mount Zion that cannot be moved. The leadership of CUPP just yesterday passed a vote of confidence on him to continue with the good work he's doing, which meets international best practices. The CUPP is not even anticipating asking him to step aside. The coalition is strongly behind him on these trying times, and we've already assured him we are on this together. An injury to one is an injury to all. In as much as the coalition is re-strategizing for 2023 general election, Ikenga Imugochinyere remains our best bet for now in the projection of our collective interests as a spokesperson.
Attorney Kenneth Udeze is the CUPP head of mobilization and leader of the Nigerian Opposition Action Alliance. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Noel Wodred, leader of the Burkina Faso Opposition Alliance for Democracy and Federation, African Democratic Rally, or ADDRDA, says his party is not impressed with the government's effort to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. He says the response of the government when the first case of the disease was confirmed was lackadaisical. Supporters of the government rejected the criticism, saying the administration has done better to limit the spread of the disease. They argue that the government has done well relatively to its neighbors, including Ghana. But opposition leader Wodrego tells me that it is clear that the government was ill-prepared to limit the spread of the disease, despite repeated promises of preparedness to combat the disease.
This pandemic has challenged most government and state around the world, including, of course, our own. In Burkina Faso, we witnessed it at the outset, purely fanciful declarations announcing that we were ready to face the pandemic. However, the appearance of the first cases, like the management of terrorism, brought to light amateurism, cacophony, and grouping at the top of the state, showing the government's notorious inability to address the concerns of people, and above all, its lack of vision. Instead, for example, of building the response on the Ebola Control Committee, which was formed and seasoned for this kind of fight, another committee was set up and worked blindly before taking its bearings. The immediate consequence of this mismanagement was the worsening of the crisis of confidence between the governed and the rulers of the day. The number of deaths recorded, the contradictory of the government, its power communication have led many of our compatriots to question the reality of the statistics communicated, when some do not believe at all in the real existence of case of coronavirus in Burkina Faso. This doubt that has arisen is not without consequence for the respect of the barrier measures. All of this has resulted in mass grumbling by the actors of the informal sector who have ended up demanding the resumption of economic activities by forceps. Beyond the economic pressure that the attitude of certain actors can justify, owns doubt and suspicion setting what we have seen inevitably follows. Let us nevertheless conclude on a positive note that Burkina Faso, like most African countries, is resisting well to the pandemic.
Are you therefore saying that your party is not impressed with the efforts to fight the spread of the disease so far in Burkina Faso?
We are simply saying that we could have managed this pandemic better and recorded fewer deaths than we did. You will notice that in the sub-region, mortality is higher in Burkina Faso.
I'm sure you've interacted with Burkinabes about the ongoing fight by the government to stop the spread or prevent the spread of the COVID-19. What has been their responses so far? And do they have confidence that the government is doing everything it can to help prevent the disease from spreading?
As I was saying earlier, the government has communicated very poorly on this issue, so much so that the public doesn't believe at all in its ability to properly manage the pandemic to the point where it is not impossible that some people with signs of the disease have chosen self-medication or to use the pharmacopoeia that is considered more credible.
I also understand that some people are asking opposition groups and civil society groups who are criticizing government's effort in the fight to prevent the spread of the disease, that what are you doing in your own capacity since you are encouraging Burkinabes to follow your lead or follow you or vote for you in the next election?
Personally, I have been heavily involved in the fight against the pandemic. Even before the head of state addressed the nation for the first time, I was the first politician in the country to record a video in the national language and in French to make my fellow citizens aware of the reality and dangerousness of the disease. After that, my party made several donations of hand washes, nose plugs, hydroalcoholic products, and gloves in the main cities. My party, the ADF-RDA, donated $4,000 worth of equipment to the Department of Health and contributed to the contribution of the entire opposition, which gave more than $10,000 to the Ministry of Health in support of the fight against the pandemic. As president of the African Liberal Network, speaking of the message to voters as a candidate in the November presidential election, I would like to say that my primary concern is the health of our fellow citizens and the measures taken by the state to support the most vulnerable and to revive our badly damaged economy. At my individual level, in these difficult times linked to the harmful repercussions of the pandemic, I am organizing food distributions for the poor.
What will be your message to the people of Burkina Faso and the government in the fight against the disease?
My message is that we can defeat the pandemic provided that the government learns from its mistakes, improves care for the sick, intensifies screening, and improves communication. To the citizens, I will tell them that the disease is real, and I will invite them to observe the barrier measures. Because by protecting others, they protect themselves.
Gilbert Noel Wadrego is the leader of the Burkina Faso Opposition Alliance for Democracy and Federation, African Democratic Rally, or ADDRDA. He spoke with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. In Sierra Leone, the Opposition Coalition for Change, or C4C, is calling for national cohesion and respect for due process to ease what it says is escalating tension in the West African country. The party says recent political developments between the government and the main opposition, All People's Congress, or APC, are increasing tensions. This after the APC accused the government of using state institutions, including the police and the judiciary, to intimidate and harass their leaders. Loris Conte, spokesperson for the opposition C4C, tells me that the president, Julius Maada Bio, should also create a multi-party coalition to join his administration's effort to prevent the spread of the coronavirus.
The Coalition for Change Party in Sierra Leone is calling for national cohesion because the country is divided along political lines. The incumbent Sierra Leone People's Party and the party that made up the last government, the All People's Congress, the APC, continues to trade blows. The incumbent accuses the APC of being terrorists and being behind all the instability that's been going on in Sierra Leone recently. The APC party, in response, saying that a lot of their members are being arrested without due process. So the country is divided. And when you have these two parties who have ruled Sierra Leone since independence, barring the coup d'etat that we had, then it is critical that Coalition for Change, being the third largest party in the country, calls for cohesion.
Party is calling for a joint message from the main opposition party and the ruling party to come out. Do you foresee this happening?
Indeed, we do foresee this happening. Firstly, we're calling for this because the message, any message, is as strong as the messenger. Secondly, we foresee this happening because there's precedence. It has happened before. There was a point in our recent history where there was a spate of violence, and the leaders of all the major parties came together. They went around the country speaking to their different constituencies, ensuring that there's peace in Sierra Leone. We are not just calling for this, however. We are ensuring that as a party, as the third largest party in Sierra Leone, we are ensuring that we intervene to try to bring these two political parties together. So yes, we do see this happening, and we see it happening pretty quickly as well.
Some are suggesting that the division you spoke about the political situation in the country, is not new, and it happens in every other country. So what is unique about Sierra Leone's situation?
The political division that we speak about in response in relation to Sierra Leone is definitely not new. However, Sierra Leone has had to deal with the Ebola virus, which decimated our country, decimated our economy. During that time, one of the major successes was the incumbent being able to bring together all political actors to come together to fight the menace. Now, COVID-19 is different only because it affects a greater proportion of the world. But ultimately, it has to be dealt with. So whether that's unique to Sierra Leone in the sense of the people will come together through their political parties in times of such grave challenges, it's not really for me to say at this point. But what I do know is that we have a history of coming together when it really, really matters.
Some say your call is just a mere publicity stunt just to stay relevant because your party has been sidelined. It's only the ruling party and the main opposition party that seem to be doing anything worthwhile mentioning in the political temperature or climate in Sierra Leone. How do you respond to that?
Well, like I said earlier, the Coalition for Change party is the third largest party in Sierra Leone. So we are a critical and an integral part of governance in Sierra Leone. Additionally, we have noted in Sierra Leone that the main opposition, the All People's Congress, have sort of jettisoned themselves from a lot of activities, a lot of things they refrain from participating in, which leaves an additional gap that the Coalition for Change party itself fills. So ultimately, for example, nothing happens in parliament if the C4C party is not involved. So that assertion that the C4C is doing this because it is not relevant would be totally wrong. We are coming from a position of our mantra, our motto, which is nation first. And the C4C is always ready to support government to ensure that we have peace and development in Sierra Leone.
Loris Conte is the spokesperson for the Sierra Leonean opposition party, the Coalition for Change, or C4C. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. prominent Tanzanian human rights activist says plans for a party to demonstrate a defeat of the coronavirus is regrettable. Attorney Fatma Karume says the announcement of the plans for the party shows a clear case of mixed messaging from the authorities about efforts to limit the spread of the disease. Her remarks come after local media quoted the commissioner for the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, Paul Makonda, as calling on residents to celebrate the end of the coronavirus in Dar es Salaam on Sunday. But attorney Karume, who is also the former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, tells me that Tanzania should rather learn from the WHO best practices other countries have implemented to stop the spread of the disease.
Yes, the infamous party to celebrate the end of COVID-19. It is clear to me that the aim of this party is to actually restart the economy in Dar es Salaam, which is our commercial city. And it's the city that accounts for over 80% of the country's tax collection. However, there is also a fear amongst the authorities of allowing Dar es Salaamites to continue life as usual. And you can see this from the messaging that is coming out with respect to Eid celebrations. The Dar es Salaam population is majority Muslim, yet as we come to the end of the month of Ramadan, we have been told that the usual public Eid celebrations will not be permitted because of the virus. Now, there is clear mixed messaging that is going on, and it is detrimental to the containment effort. The government cannot ride two horses at the same time.
Fatma, what are your views about reports that the government has not updated its information with regards to the rate of infection in Tanzania, so the world will know what the situation is regarding the spread of the coronavirus in Tanzania?
When a government decides to withhold information regarding a pandemic to its people, the question becomes one of human rights. Because we have to ask ourselves, why do we require governments to provide this information? And in my view, we require governments to provide this information so that the population, the general population, can make informed decisions with respect to their health. And health leads directly to the right to life. And this is a fundamental right that we all have as human beings. So when a government refuses to give this information to its people or is negligent about giving this information to its people, the question then becomes one of human rights and the right to people to enjoy their life and to live. And unfortunately, this leads to a much more fundamental issue, which is, what if hundreds of thousands of Tanzanians die from this disease? Who is going to be held accountable? Will we be looking at accountability for those who refuse to give this information to the people?
Well, we understand the government has issued a directive encouraging the reopening of colleges, sports and tourism. What is your reaction about this?
Peter, it ought to be noted that Tanzania has not taken any significant measures to arrest the spread of this virus. The government has only closed schools, universities and public sports events. In addition, the government has stopped providing any data on the virus since mid-April this year, citing sabotage of the national laboratory by, of all people, foreigners. We have seen countries easing lockdown only after being satisfied that the infection rates had decreased significantly. And to my mind, this can only be determined by prolific testing. I am concerned that Tanzania is easing the limited measures it has taken to arrest the spread of COVID-19 without satisfying itself through tests that infection rates have actually decreased. This, to me, is a recipe for disaster.
Well, Fatma, there's a suggestion that perhaps the peak or the curve in the fight against the spread of the disease has been reached, and that is why the government is taking steps now methodically to open up the economy as well as open schools and sports activities. What do you make of this?
The use of the word methodically is misconceived. There is no method in the steps undertaken by the government. Method would require, one, extensive testing, two, evidence that infections have decreased.
there is no extensive testing in Tanzania, and therefore, where did the government get its evidence that infections have decreased?
Ms. Fatma, are you therefore saying that the government has not been impressive in the way it's implementing measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus in Tanzania?
In my view, the measures implemented by the government are inadequate, but this is a subjective view. However, there are only two ways we can arrive at an objective determination on the effectiveness of these measures. I think the first is by testing and tracking the spread of the virus. And the second is by waiting and seeing the wait and see approach. And we need to wait and see how many people will succumb and die from the virus. This approach, to my mind, would be a rather callous way at arriving at an objective answer to your question. The WHO has set out best practices. In my view, one need only follow these practices whilst amending them to suit our particular environment. There are also examples of countries that have managed to contain this virus, from what one would call China's extremely restrictive approach to the more flexible New Zealand approach. Again, let's learn from successful countries. I'm not a believer of reinventing the wheel, Peter, or in our case, ignoring perfectly sound scientific recommendations.
Attorney Fatma Karume is a human rights activist and a former president of the Tanganyika Law Society. She spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Uganda, the Women's Protest Working Group is calling on the government for a review of the lockdown restrictions. The human rights group says the restrictions have imposed financial difficulties on the less fortunate. The administration imposed restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of the coronavirus. The measures, officials say, are the main reason why the disease has not been widespread in the East African country. Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, a prominent member of the women's group, tells me that the organization is also demanding the release of all political prisoners.
The Women's Protest Working Group, which is it's a concept, a convener that brings us together to just go about society's ills, has indeed petitioned the Prime Minister. We were arrested and brought some disorganization by the police while we were setting off to go petition the Prime Minister, and they confiscated most of the things we have, but we are very sure that by now he has received his copy, either on social media or via the police that confiscated the main copy that was with Dr. Stella Nyanzi. The petition is a food petition. It is about food. It is about food for common wananchi. Wananchi means citizens. Food for the common Ugandan. Government came out and set aside a bill of 59 billion shillings that was intended to buy food for vulnerable Ugandans during this COVID. The Uganda government has received donations both locally and internationally from namely EU, US mission, and various other international bodies, including UN. But as we speak, I, as an individual woman, every day I get messages from fellow women with their children, with grandmothers starving. They basically have no food. And our questions are, where is the money that was budgeted by Parliament to buy people's food? Where is the food that should come from the donations for COVID response? These are the questions we are asking. We need food, twagala mere, for our communities.
What do you say to those who are of the view that there's evidence to prove that food has been distributed and necessities are distributed by the COVID task force all across the country to help people or the less fortunate to cope with the restrictions imposed by the government to halt the spread of the disease?
Say to such people is that you know, being maybe naive, or maybe they are not naive, but they have given in to the lies. I can't even censure that. It's pure lies. Because most people, like we have named it on social media, most Ugandans are calling this television food, TV food, because all we see is a lot of big news about the food on television and radio. But home to home, there is no food in these communities. In the community I live, my next neighbor and next neighbor, it's not hard to tell. I mean, tonight the news on television, it had university students starving from their various universities where the lockdown found them. I have individual messages from the women that relate with me as a rights defender telling me about it. They are like, Nana, you're the one that speaks for women. You and Dr. Stella and the others, we have waited for the food and we haven't seen it. I have evidence. It's pure lies. They just used a few examples. They went to a few areas, took a lot of pictures there. They took cameras there to tell the world how Uganda had supported its vulnerable during COVID. The truth of the matter on the ground is people are hungry and on the verge of starvation.
Nana, one of the requests in your petition is for the government to release all political prisoners. Supporters of the government are saying that this unveils the true rationale behind your petition and that it is not to seek the well-being of the underprivileged in society, but politically motivated to score cheap political points and make the government unpopular. How do you react to that?
The women's protest group is not a political situation. This is a concept that was come around to just touch society's ills as they come. Issues of women, issues of children, inequality. And Uganda on the African soil is one of the most unequal societies that I know as a person who is not really politician per se. I stand for rights. But like the convener convenes everybody, some of us, for example, Dr. Stella Nyanzi, the convener of the whole concept, has political views. But it's no news to anyone in Africa or world over that this government is already unpopular, even to little children. They know that. No wonder people have lost total trust. If you look at the people that are giving in, it's either foreigners or big international bodies, maybe people from the Asian descent. But the local Ugandan, they have lost trust completely. Therefore, I don't see who would be putting any effort in making unpopular a situation that's already unpopular. The situation is unpopular on itself by its own deeds, and it doesn't take us coming out and telling them that people are hungry and therefore we need the people's food and we need accountability. That's not what makes it unpopular. It's already extremely, very unpopular.
Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, is a prominent member of the Women's Protest Working Group. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Dr. Cynthia Kluji and Dr. Jasmine Kluji are a family duo who are scheduled to begin their residency at Louisiana State University Health Science Center on July 1. The mother and daughter physicians attended separate medical schools at the same time and graduated this year with their respective degrees. Mother, Dr. Cynthia Kluji, graduated to practice family medicine, while her daughter, Dr. Jasmine Kluji, graduated with a degree in general surgery. Their inspirational story has been trending on social media platforms. In an interview with VOA, the family physicians say they plan to establish a joint practice after their residency and then give back to Africa. To learn more about their unique and inspirational story, I caught up with the mother and daughter medical doctors. In part one of the interview, I asked the family duo about their journey and their future plans.
Initially, I had gone to visit Ghana when I was 17 years old. My mom, it was very important for my mom and my dad, to them, that we go and visit Ghana. So I did that. And when we were there, it was the most amazing trip. Really wanted to be a physician. Had ended up coming back to the U.S., went to Tulane, and found myself pregnant by my senior year. And then my pastor was like, why don't you be a nurse? And I was like, I don't want to be a nurse. And he was like, no, at least you'll learn medicine. So I did that, and I worked as a nursing assistant, worked as a maid, and became an RN. And then Jasmine was still too young for me to go to medical school, so then I became a nurse practitioner. And then after 9 or 10 years of being an NP, I decided to go to medical school.
Well, because I grew up seeing my mom as a nurse and as a nurse practitioner, she brought me everywhere with her. I would go see patients with her. Sometimes I went to classes with her. So very early on, I had encounters with patients and with the medical field. And so she kind of instilled in me that, you know, medicine was the way to go. And for me, I realized that, you know, I really had a connection to it. I love the fact that it was a position of service and that I could help my community. And so when I went to college, even though I majored in English, I still took all my science courses to make sure that I could still apply to medical school. And during that time, my mom also applied to medical school. So it was a great time for both of us.
I meant, were both of you at the same medical school at the same time?
I went to medical school when Jasmine had started her undergraduate. And then while I was in medical school, I found out that Jasmine had also got accepted into medical school. So from that point on, we were in medical school until we finished. I finished December 31st, 2019, and she finished May, I think last week. And my graduation was also supposed to be last week. So we did this entire journey of medical school together. So Jasmine went to Louisiana State, LSU, Louisiana State University School of Medicine. So I went to the University of Medicine and Health Sciences, which was located in St. Kitts.
Yes, both of us were in medical school at the same time. My mom began first, and then I began after her. And we just happened to finish at the same time, which was amazing.
What reaction have you received so far after your story came out and published on various social media platforms?
So I went to LSU in New Orleans for medical school, and my mom went to University of Medicine and Health Sciences in St. Kitts. There was a time during my mom's fourth year where she actually did a rotation in Lafayette, Louisiana with me, and that was amazing. We were both on our family medicine rotation together. And we got to see patients together. We got to spend 6 weeks together, which was a long time, seeing as we had been apart for so long. So that was probably one of the greatest experiences during our medical school careers together. The response from people all around the world has been unbelievable and overwhelming. I mean, we've received messages from people all over the United States, all over Africa. I've received messages from people in Spain, just all sorts of places. It's unbelievable with technology how far and how easily word can spread. And we're just so grateful for everyone's positive response and for everyone's support.
I would even add to that that we've even got a response from the U.S. Embassy in Ghana, just, you know, acknowledging our achievements. And it's just been a very humbling experience and for our family and for us. And it's been such an honor.
So when I told people I will be talking to the two of you, they were excited and they asked me, will there be any plans for you to go back to any African country and to Ghana as well to help with what you've achieved so far?
That has always been a part of our plan, to be able to give back, because truly we stand on the shoulders of those that come before us. And we are humbled by the support that we've received from our family and friends, both in the U.S. and in Ghana. So absolutely, we plan on coming back to give back.
It is 100% our dream and our goal to be able to go back to Ghana and other parts of Africa to be able to help. We were actually supposed to be in Ghana this weekend. We were supposed to take a family trip there, but because of everything that's happening with the corona pandemic, we had to cancel our trip. But definitely in the future, hopefully the near future, we'll be able to, you know, start clinics there and just be able to help in a way that we haven't been before.
Dr. Cynthia Kluge and Dr. Jasmine Kluge are a family duo of medical doctors. They spoke with me from Louisiana here in the United States. 8 people have been confirmed dead and several others injured and unaccounted for following fresh floods that hit Uganda's Kasese district. The floods that swept through Mpondwe-Buera border point have also cut off entry into the Democratic Republic of Congo. For VOA, Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
5 of the dead are members of the same family who were sleeping in their house when the flood swept it away. Joshua Masereka is the Kasese Deputy Resident District Commissioner.
Yes, it is a family of one called Moses, the wife, the mother, and the 2 children have been swept off by the water. This was a landslide. A school has been washed away, and the whole sub-county is cut off.
Also among the dead is a Uganda People's Defense Forces officer, Dothorach Lokwang, attached to Mountain Battalion in Buera. He was manning a porous border in the area and died trying to rescue a mother and her child from being swept away by the floods. 3 other soldiers were rescued and rushed to the hospital for medical attention. Winnie Kiza, an area legislator, says some of the bodies have been found over the border in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So we would request that the government of Uganda works hand in hand with the Congolese government so that those bodies can be returned back home.
The police, UPDF and residents continue to search for survivors and bodies. Pole Namaye is the deputy Uganda police spokesperson.
There are still some missing persons whom we have not yet recovered, and we are not sure if they are alive or dead, but we were informed that they were missing and we are looking for them. We are still on the rescue mission, and we are hoping that we shall recover the missing persons.
To reverse the Rubiriha and Kabira burst their banks, sweeping everything in their way, including bridges, roads, schools and homes. The bridge connecting Uganda to the Democratic Republic of Congo has not been spared. Sylvester Mpozi is the mayor of Mpondwe, a town on the border.
With logs, with mud, only it can be used when the excavators have desilted the sand from the bridge. No business, no crossing, even cargoes. Those which are Congo are in Congo, and here you can't move. Even the other sub-county, Chitolu, the bridge is off, it has been swept off. You can't also access that area. That's where we had also been getting food. So no access of food from there, and even DRC, you can't reach there.
Trucks are currently piling up at the DRC-Uganda border. Uganda's Minister of Disaster Preparedness, Musa Icheru, is in Kasese to assess the situation. He says government teams will be deployed to restore connectivity to DRC and desilt the rivers to prevent further flooding. This is the third time in a month that rivers in Kasese district have flooded, leaving people devastated and destroying household property and crops. More than 10,000 people are thought to be displaced by the latest floods. As rains continue in the area, the officials have asked residents to leave flood-prone areas until a permanent solution is found. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Oh my God.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Oh, the girl them zaddy. The girl them zaddy. Can you give me 1 minute attention? I'll go down and swear for you. When my name be what your lips they mention, I go be right by you. Enemy slow progression, them they watch our moves. Doubting me never go ever. Baby, I go need your groove. And I know what you're thinking, so I go try a little harder. All these things that I'm doing, only to get you to love my matter. So you can bring on your girlfriends, so we party harder. And you can tell them I'm your best friend. Never mind. I'm a walker, walk you to the market. Treat you like a lady, like a lady, like a lady. Oh, I go
river, I go come carry water. I go full up the gen set for the power. Treat you like a lady, like a baby, like a lady, yo. Girl, I know, say you doubt me, so I go try a little harder. All these things I be doing, only to get you to love my matter. And you can bring all your GMs, so we party hard, oh.
Yeah.
city. Yo, everything I do is a lifestyle. Oh. I don't make I use my diplomacy. Yeah, but people do like hypocrisy. Yeah, my diamonds and my cars, now freestyle. I'm a shooting star, I'm a blockbuster, I'm a young stunner, I'm a stockbroker. So many haters on my Instagram, on my Twitter, so many flows. I'm a shooting star, I'm a blockbuster, I'm a young stunner, freedom fighter. So many haters on my Instagram, on my Twitter, so many flows. To the boom, Zagwe Adafa, Arabada Alifa, Eomaru Mefa, Kilodetans of New Broom Go Sweet Better. Then told the propaganda from January to December. We look by the Nepal. So all of our youth will go America. Hey, hey, Baba Tete Sheo, hey, you don't know who I am. Baba Tete Sheo, hey, you shake who I am. Hey, hey, Baba Tete Sheo. I'm Mr. Booker. So many haters on my Instagram, on my Twitter, so many flows. I'm a shooting star, I'm a blockbuster, I'm a young stunner, freedom fighter. So many haters on my Instagram, on my Twitter, so many flows.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mbuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, an old lady feels uneasy when dry bones are mentioned in a proverb. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.